Okay, does everybody have working with the yellow and green sheets? So our goal today is to finish this series. You can imagine this took us just one night on Shavuos, and this took us 3 weeks, and even today it's going to be a rush. But okay, so I apologize for cramming it in, but such is life, at least for this. We're going to begin today in the last two segments, beginning with this set of yellow sheets, part four, starting in the year 1616, and then moving to the green. Maybe we'll move. So the next segment of the five figures we're going to focus on is, we'll start with Rav Yonasan Eibeshitz on the front of the yellows. Welcome my in-laws, my father-in-law. So you have one of these. Let's get a set. So if you look on the inside of your map, if you look on your own personal map on the inside cover, you see on the number one, you see Hamburg there. Rav Yonasan Eibeshitz is born around the year 1690, maybe 1695. A child prodigy, studied in Poland and in Prague. And he settles in Prague in 1715, becomes the head of yeshiva, and in 1725, this is a very important note, he becomes one of the group of rabbis who pronounces a ban against a specific group of people. So in the 17th century, but now, remember, now we're in 1725, we're talking decades later, the Jewish community is still reeling from the effects of a false Messiah. We don't have time to talk about it this morning, Ba'arichas, but there was a man, his name was Shabsai Tzvi, traveled to Israel, had a disciple, Nathan of Gaza, who, a long, very, very long story on one foot, proclaimed, he decided that he was the Mashiach, he's the Messiah, and there were many individuals, including great rabbinic scholars in the 17th century, who bought into the idea that Shabsai Tzvi was the Messiah. Then, in the 1660s, things start to go sour. He's being persecuted. He makes his way. He's in Istanbul, in Turkey. He converts to Islam. And there are still people who think that Shabsai Tzvi is the Messiah. And then he dies, and there are still people. So there is this kind of lingering effect, which we're not going to talk about today, but it is a lingering effect, which, remember, we spoke about last time, the fact that in the 16th century, with the rise of the influence of Torah Sasot, Kabbalah, especially in Tzfat, places like that, there is a lot of emphasis on this mysticism, and then you have a false Messiah. So there's a huge amount of tumult that's happening now at the beginning of the 18th century. So comes Rav Yonasan Eibeshitz in Prague with another group of rabbis who pronounce a ban on the followers of Shabsai Tzvi. You're talking decades later, and there's still such a strong affinity for Shabsai Tzvi, who's long dead and long discredited. It's hard for us to imagine. It would be like putting a ban on people who think that Elvis is still alive. Seriously. However, in 1736, he becomes the Dayan of Prague, and then in 1741, he becomes the rabbi in Metz. Now, Metz, if you look on our map, so Metz is here. We had it on a French map a couple of weeks ago. Metz is here in the eastern edge of France, and it's one of the most prestigious Jewish communities in Western Europe. Later on, the Chagas Aryeh, Rav Aryeh Leib Ginsberg, of great rabbinic fame, is going to become a rabbi of this town. And then after that, he becomes the rabbi of the three communities, which is on your map in number one, which are Hamburg, Altena, and Wandsbek in 1750. He was considered a great preacher. He was the chief rabbi, which means now he's responsible for kashrus and for all the community institutions and for the Beis Din and for Geirus and everything. That's all under his purview. And he is regarded as likely the greatest rabbinic sage of the era. The Gadol Hador. He published works on the Shulchan Aruch that include the Urim V'Tumim on Choshen Mishpat. He publishes the Kresu Plesi on Yoredei. He publishes a work on the Rambam called B'nai Ahuva. He publishes Drushas, which we'll see in a minute, called Yaros Devash. And then, a controversy breaks out. And I can't really explain this controversy because so much has been written about it. Obviously, it takes great scholarship, and that's one of the travesties of what we're doing this with this project, is that we're only giving just a thumbnail sketch. On Thursday, I think I'm out. I should have brought more. I'm sorry. Working with yellow and green. On February 4th, 1751, there was a man who's living in Altona. His father was one of the great rabbinic authorities of the previous generation, lived in Amsterdam. His name was the Chacham Tzvi. Chacham Tzvi maybe had something to do with Rembrandt, but in his own right, he was a great gadol. He has very many, many very important tshuvas, and the child is the tshuvas Chacham Tzvi. His son was a Talmud Chacham, no question. He was the author of a work on the Torah called the Moruk Tzia. And at this private minyan that he had, like a shtiebel, the man by the name of Rav Yaakov Emden, known as Yaibitz, Yaakov Ben Tzvi, he announced on Thursday, February 4th, 1751, that an amulet ascribed to the chief rabbi, to Rav Yonason Eibeshitz, could only have been written by a follower of Shabbosai Tzvi. This begins the mega controversy of the 1700s, the 18th century. Because after that, Rav Yaakov Emden, who had access to a printing press, began a campaign, an unceasing campaign, to claim that the local chief rabbi of the three communities was, in fact, a Sabbatian, a Shabbosai Tzvinik. So there has been enormous amounts written about this, and if you want more information, there are several great articles authored by Rabbi Dr. Schneer Lyman. So Schneer has a website called lymanlibrary.org where you can get full text, 100 of his articles. You just have to click on the bottom where it says bibliography. So he has four different articles related to, which is where I got a lot of the information, related to the controversy between the chief rabbi and Rav Yaakov Emden. Rav Yaakov Emden is saying that all of the kashrus in the city is treif, that the chief rabbi is a heretic. Think about the significance. And then it becomes not just a controversy in the three communities in Germany, it becomes a controversy throughout the rabbinic world. Letters are sent to great rabbinic authorities, and different rabbis take different sides. So if you look there, Schneer has different opinions. He cites different opinions on how to relate to this controversy between Rav Yonason Eibeshitz and Rav Yaakov Emden. One of the people who weighs in on this controversy we mentioned last week was the Notabi Yehuda. The Notabi Yehuda sends a letter. At that time, he was not yet in Prague, Rav Yecheskel Landau. He sends a letter saying, look, we got to balance this out. On the one hand, Rav Yonason Eibeshitz is unquestionably the Gadol Hador. On the other hand, these amulets are a problem. They are Sabbatian. And had they not been written by Rav Yonason Eibeshitz, we would say that the author is in fact a Sabbatian. So they have to be taken out of circulation. We're not used to amulets because many of us are not into Kabbalah and the writing of these mystical texts. But he says Rav Yonason Eibeshitz was wrong to put Rav Yaakov Emden in Cherem, in excommunication, because there was a ban back and forth. The followers of Yaakov Emden versus the followers of Yonason Eibeshitz became a terrible controversy, kind of unresolved. As a Kohen, I don't do grave hopping, but someone told me that they were in the cemetery and they happened to be buried right near each other. Rav Yaakov Emden died in 1764. Rav Yonason Eibeshitz Rav Yonason Eibeshitz dies in 1764. Rav Yaakov Emden dies almost 10 years later. I think it was 1773. But this becomes the controversy of the time. People like the Pnei Yoshua, the Vilna Gaon, many other great rabbinic luminaries are getting involved, and there isn't really a clear conclusion. Nonetheless, Rav Yaakov Emden maintained that he was right, and Rav Yonason Eibeshitz maintained that he was right. Rav Yonason Eibeshitz's works still remain a very important part of rabbinic literature. So when I was talking to Rav Schwartz, he shall have Refuah Shleima, so I asked him, so which piece would you use from the Yaros Dvash? Because I wanted to use something from the Drushos. So immediately he said, in the Yaros Dvash, there's a drasha on the Shmona Esrei, which of course I had no idea. So I looked in the Yaros Dvash, which is on your page here, and he has a beautiful drasha on the Shmona Esrei. And the choice was not so easy which one to pick. So I picked, in honor of Rav Schwartz, you should have Refu Shleim, I picked the bracha of Rifa'enu. So if you see, it's on page Chafalov here in the Aris Tavash. I'm sorry, we didn't mention the Nota Behuda last week. We're going to mention the Nota Behuda right now. Bebirchas Rifa'enu, and Rifa'enu says, Rav Yonasan Abishitz, Yispalo ba'ad kol cholam shem besochair, v'yichlol kol chole Yisrael. You should include, when you pray in the bracha of Rifa'enu, not just for the sick people that you know, but all the sick people in the community, and all of the sick people of Israel. And he says, you should not say, don't think that, oh, I don't know them, they're not connected to me, because he says here on long 4, ki halo kol nefesh achas, v'guf echad. All Jews are one entity. V'imchala echad mi Yisrael, harikzas me'evar of cholim. If one person is ill, one person is affected by something, so then everyone is affected by it. A person, God forbid, so they have a toothache. So they don't say, well, my tooth hurts, but everything else is fine. Their whole being hurts. So he says, similarly, you should daven for all cholim, because they're all part of you. But it's not just that. You should also daven even for the wicked people, even for the Rishayim. Second column. So he says, look on line 5. Second column, left-hand side. V'imhu rasha gamar pshita sheishispal avur b'riyusa leval yamos chayav. Of course, if you have a wicked person, you should pray that they should have refuah shalema, that they shouldn't die when they are chayav, that they should be able to do tshuva. Tshuva. V'ulai kasher yashav l'v'riyusa yisakin asher chishiches v'ad yomoso yechakalo ulai yashav u'pshita d'yeshispal avuro. Because they're part of the organism, the Jewish people. If that person dies without a tikkun, so then all of us are lacking. But not just that. Look at line 17. Ve'od yesh tam l'spala avur adam rasha, gam kein ki yiyeh mi sheyiyeh, should daven for any wicked person. Why? Yesh rischa b'mosel l'mayla. When that person passes away, there is a judgment that exists in the world. And that person is being judged. There's a measure of judgment that extends to all of us. So therefore, he says, and then he continues the whole next page, which we're not going to take the time to look at, on the concept of Rifa'enu, how do you define yourself? Do you define yourself just as yourself, or do you see yourself as part of something much bigger of the Jewish people? And maybe that's why all the brachas in the Shemona Esrei, when you have bakashas, they're all in Lashon Rabim. It's Rifa'enu, not Rifa'eni. Let's move to our next figure, turn the page. Rav Yechezkel ben Yehuda Landau, I mentioned him a second ago, I didn't realize we're out of order. Born in 1713 in Poland, in Opatow. He learned in Brody. He came from a wealthy and distinguished family. At the age of 18, he married, and he joined the Klois in Brody, studying Gemara and Kabbalah. At the age of 21, he was already a Dayan, and at 33, he was the rabbi of Yampol. And in 1754, he becomes the rabbi of Prague. In Yampol is when he sends this, what he called, like, the Igeres Shlomim, trying to make a truce between Rav Yaakov Emden and the chief rabbi, Rav Yonasan Eibeshitz. He sent his letter from Yampol. It was before he lived in Prague. His volumes, which are here on your next page, called Nota Behuda, published in 1776 and 1811, contain about 860 responsa. This is one of the most significant rabbinic figures of the 18th century. So he's living in Prague. Some people have heard there's a legend about his home and different things in his life. People go to Prague. They have all kinds of... It's important to differentiate between history and legend. But the Nota Behuda, from a halachic standpoint, was a hugely significant figure. So Baruch Hashem, we look around today, this group is amazing and huge. Several years ago, this is not the first year we've been doing this year, several years ago, some of us looked at this tshuva, but I'm bringing it back because not everybody remembers it. We studied this tshuva a couple of years ago. This tshuva is a fascinating tshuva. If you look on the first page where it starts on the top, tshuva shalom lahai tsorev ha'osek b'chukei chorev, Rev Gimfrecht Oppenheim. So his question is the following. Look on the third line. A man who Hashem has blessed him with a grand expanse. He has villages and forests. And Asher Bahaya Aros Tirmos Kol Chai Soyar. In this forest romp all kinds of wild animals. Imuter lo lelech ba'atzmo liros bekanei sreifa. If it's permitted to him to go to liros to shoot with a kane sreifa, a stick of fire. What's a stick of fire?
A gun.
Firearms. A stick that shoots fire. Can I go hunting on my property with a rifle? That's the Shiloh. Fascinating Shiloh. So, the first question is Tzar Balei Chaim. Second question is Baal Tashchis. So first he discusses the question of Baal Tashchis and Tzar Balei Chaim, and then the question of, you could say utility. You know, how much use is there versus how much destruction is there, which is a general question. When you talk about Baal Tashchis, you're always weighing and measuring. You know, is there, obviously there is a destructive act, but is there a constructive purpose for some reason that you're doing this? So that's a general question. You know, let's say, I'm trying to give a good example. Let's say, unfortunately, a person is cold in the wintertime and they don't have fuel to heat their furnace. They're impoverished. So can they take a wood cutting board from their cupboard and throw it in the fire? So it's Baal Tashchis is destroying the cupboard, but of course there's a constructive purpose of keeping warm, the Tzorach HaGuf, so that's going to be permitted. So the Notam Yehuda makes two comments here. One is a Hashkafic comment, which is important, and then is a Halachic comment, which is extremely important. Look on line 50 for those who have the sheets, or 51. V'omnam ma'or ani tameh al guf hadavar. I don't understand this whole thing, hunting. What's meant us hunting? V'lo matzinu ish tzayid rak ben nimrod ve'esav. V'ein zed darki b'nei Avram Yitzchak v'yakov. Says, well, this is not our kind. We don't go hunting, killing animals. What are you talking about? That's what he continues. But then on the next page, turn the packet over. So he says, you have to keep another thing in mind, which is, there is a dangerous element here. Line 29. Umeata ani omer sheyesh bedover ze iser vegam sakana. He says, I'm concerned about this. I think there's an iser because there's a danger. Going out, what's that? Right. Going out, you may get shot by somebody else who's in your hunting party. Happens. Or you might get mauled by a wild animal. It might be dangerous. So in this tshuva, the Notam Yehuda makes a very important distinction. He says, wait a second. The context in which we raised this tshuva a couple of years ago was, unfortunately, if you remember, there was a woman who was killed training a killer whale. So the question was whether or not halachically it's appropriate to be a whale trainer. Happens to be that we found out that now SeaWorld is getting rid of their orca program. Just so if you want to hop around to see the killer whales, go now before they're gone. Otherwise, you have to go scuba diving in Vancouver or something. The question is, wait a second, training killer whales, everybody knows is dangerous. What about being a window washer on the 78th floor of some high-rise in the city? What about other kinds of businesses that are not so, you know, they're not so simple? So the Notam Yehuda quotes based on a Gemara in Brachos is a very important distinction. He says there's a difference between recreation and employment. The Pasuk says, Ve'elav hu noseyes nafsho. You have to be careful about your employees and you have to take care of them properly because Ve'elav hu noseyes nafsho, so to speak, he takes his life in his hands. What do you mean he takes his life in his hands? Because a person who would go up on a ladder into a tree, you know, picking vegetables, fruits in a tree, if he falls out of the tree, he could break his neck and die. Wait a second, how is he allowed to go up to the tree? So the Notam Yehuda points out based on this Gemara in Brachos that when it comes to a person's parnasa, when it comes to making a living, we're more lenient when it comes to the kinds of risks that they can take. You know, lawyers, what kind of risk? God forbid, it shouldn't have carpal tunnel syndrome from writing too many notes. You know, physicians might have a greater risk. God forbid, someone might get a needle stick or something like that. When it comes to recreation, The Note of Yehuda says we have a high threshold for saying you have to worry about Nushmartim Ilda Nafsha Sechem. You want to go, I don't know, bungee jumping without a bungee cord. I don't know, Jules, now you're retired. You're thinking, fun things to do, good idea. Not allowed. Not allowed. It's dangerous. But if somebody says that this is the parnasa they can have, and one might even argue, somebody is drawn, let's say their whole mahus, they love being with animals, and they're not going to go to veterinary school, they want to be an animal trainer in the circus in a very humane way. So who's to tell that person that they can't follow their dream? And because that's their parnasa, the Note of Yehuda says that would be more permitted. But just to go to the forest and endanger your life wrestling with wild animals and alligators, so if it's not what you do for a living, it should be avoided. Let's turn to the next page, and we're going to begin kind of the last phase, which you'll see at the top of this chart here on the table, begins with the Gaon of Vilna. Rav Eliyahu ben Rav Shlomo Zalman, born in 1720, one of the greatest spiritual intellectual leaders of the Jewish people in modern times. On the one hand, he was an intellectual and a hermit, in a certain sense. In the beginning of his life, he lived in a very, very closed lifestyle, just learning by himself. On the other hand, he then began to teach several of his pupils, including Rabbi Yisrael Mishkalov and Rabbi Chaim of Volozhin and others in a small circle. He was from a rabbinic family that included the author of the Be'er HaGola, Rav Moshe Rivkus, who we mentioned last week, who was affected by the Khmelnytsky massacres in the 17th century. He was an expert in Kabbalah, in Halacha. He also, if you look in the introduction to the Pa'as HaShulchan of his student, Rav Yisrael Mishklov, he speaks about the fact that the Gaon was an expert in mathematics, also in music, and many other disciplines of the day. Apparently, some say that his father wanted to encourage him. He had thought about going to medical school, but his father encouraged him to stay in learning, which we're very grateful that he did that. He was supported by this family trust of the family of the Be'er HaGola, Rav Moshe Rivkus. And he married, settled in Vilna, and he would close his windows during the day and only learn by candlelight so he would not be disturbed. The dedication of the Vilna Gaon, I think his son said that he didn't sleep more than 2 hours a day in four increments. So it was a half hour for four pieces every 24-hour period. However, when he was 40, he shifted from his very closed and closeted way of learning to introducing and welcoming several Talmidim. So he had a little Beis Medrash and a study. It was established in 1768, and several of his students included Rav Simcha of Shklov, Rav Chaim Voloshiner, and others. He didn't have a lot of friends, let's just say, although he did have one colleague to whom he looked for Musar. Some of you have heard of the Dubno Magid. Dubna Magid, Rabbi Yaakov Halevi Krantz, my great-great-great-great-something grandfather, my grandmother, she'll live me well, the one in Yerushalayim. So her maiden name is Krantz. Her father was a Levi. They're direct descendants of the Dubna Magid. So Dubna Magid was Rabbi Yaakov Halevi Krantz, and he was kind of an itinerant, a very well-known itinerant preacher, a saintly figure. So the Vilna Gaon actually approached the Dubna Magid. They would speak sometimes. They would ask him for Musar. But none of that notwithstanding, at that time, and this is the figure who we're going to talk about next, in 1772, a man by the name of Rav Shneur Zalman of Liadi, together with Rav Nachum Mendel of Vitebsk, also in 1777, they tried to approach the Gaon to talk to him about this nascent movement that had been started a few years earlier by the name of Rav Yisrael Baal Shem, who we spoke about last year in this series, and we're not going to talk about the Baal Shem this year. But the Baal Shem Tov started Chassidus, and the Vilna Gaon was vehemently opposed. Not only that, he refused to see the Alter Rebbe, Rav Shneur Zalman of Liadi, when he came to Vilna to find the Gaon. And in 1781, after the publication of the Toldos, Rav Yaakov Yosef of Polonia's work, so the Gaon introduced a ban, an excommunication against Chassidim. And then this became kind of like the family of what we call Misnagdim, Lithuanian anti-Hasidic followers. And this became kind of the tradition over the next couple of centuries of the Hasidim and the Misnagdim. So the chief disciple of the Vilna Gaon was Rav Chaim Volozhiner. You see at the top after the Vilna Gaon, that picture, that's the picture of the Volozhin Yeshiva. So Reb Chaim Volozhiner, who wrote, I think we mentioned him last year, he wrote the Nefesh HaChaim. Many suggest that the Nefesh HaChaim, it's a deeply Kabbalistic work. The Vilna Gaon was a deep Kabbalist, was actually in opposition to, it was written specifically to oppose the early works of Hasidus, the original works of the Hasidic masters of that time. So the Vilna Gaon is mostly kind of a closed book when it comes to his writings. He wrote very, very small glosses on the side of his Shulchan Aruch and a couple of other small works. Most of his rulings and opinions are teased out of those small glosses, and then some of them are collected in writings of his students in, let's say, one volume is called Ma'aser Rav. This is what the Gra did, the Gaon Rav Elio. So many devotees of the Vilna Gaon, they follow what it says in the Ma'aser Rav. So, for example, the Vilna Gaon was such a genius, he was on the level, essentially, of arguing with Rishonim, of the Rambam and others. The Vilna Gaon was a great rabbinic figure, and following him, let's say in that line, Rav Chaim Volozhiner, the yeshiva world. So there are many in the yeshiva world who stuck with the Vilna Gaon. So I'll give you one example. The Vilna Gaon is of the opinion, he follows in line with some Rishonim, that at the Seder, you only have two matzahs, not three. This is a machlokas in the Gemara Pesachim, how to read the Gemara. The Vilna Gaon is of the opinion. So let's say, if I'm not mistaken, someone told me that the Soloveitchik family, who are very, very close to the Masorah of the Vilna Gaon, so they only have two matzahs. Why? What's the difference between two matzahs and three matzahs? So the reason you have three matzahs is because when you have your Suda on Yantif, you want to have Lecha Mishnah. But if you have only two matzahs, one is a Shalim and the other one is a Prusa, it's broken because of Lechem Oni, pauper's bread. So therefore, the majority opinion is you have three matzahs. That's why when you say Hamotzi Lechem in Haaretz, you hold all three matzahs because you have two whole matzahs with a broken one in the middle. And then when you say Al Achilas Matzah, you drop the bottom matzah because you don't need two whole matzahs for Al Achilas Matzah. The mitzvah Achilas Matzah is from the broken matzah. But the Vilna Gaon felt his opinion based on his analysis, which is not a lone figure, but he says, no, on Pesach, the broken matzah, that is your Lechem Mishnah. You don't need to add a whole, and therefore, you have two matzahs. It happens to be one of them is broken, but the mitzvah of the day is to eat broken matzahs. So you'll see, there are people in the community who follow the Minhag HaGra, it's referred to. But I wanted to share with you today a beautiful idea from the Gaon, which is actually not halachic at all. It's an idea that appears in Aderes Elio. The similar idea also appears in the Vilna Gaon's explanation of Mishlei, where he says, on the bottom, on column one, v'hamitzvah nechlak l'shlosha. Every mitzvah, or all mitzvahs in general, can be broken into three parts. We like to think of mitzvahs as two realms. Bein adam l'makom, between us and God, and bein adam l'chaveru, between us and our fellow. But the Gra, we're not going to see it inside because of time, the Gra says actually, there's a third arena. That's called bein adam l'atzma, we can call. A person and themselves. Haiman, a person, the Gemara says in Bava Kamma, wants to become a chassida. So the first opinion of the Gemara is, one opinion is, yikai mili de brachos. You should fulfill things, the area of brachos, very punctiliously. That's your relationship with God. It's thanking God for everything you have. That's bein adam l'makom. The next opinion of the Gemara is, yikai mili de nezikin. You should be careful about interpersonal damages. You know, you shouldn't run over somebody else's foot when you're driving, and you should be careful not to break their window with your baseball bat, v'chule v'chule. And the third opinion is Yekayim Milei De'Avos. What is Avos? What is Pirkei Avos? It's personal character development. It's different than Bein Adam L'Makom, between you and God. That's religious action. It's different than you and other people. That's Bein Adam L'Chaveru. That's interpersonal. This is Bein Adam L'Atzmo. What kind of person are you? So the Gra develops this idea that this is the three things that the world stands on. Torah, Avodah, and Gemilas Chasadim. Ein Sham. Okay, let's move along. Let's go to the next page. We're moving quickly because I know we got to accomplish a lot. The Alter Rebbe, Bishner Zalman of Liadi, born in 1745, the founder of Chabad Chasidus. He was born on, anybody know what day he was born? Chai Elul. So for those of you who have Fabrengans on Chai Elul, now you know why. It's because he was born on the 18th day of Elul, and, by the way, we also have another Chabad holiday on Yat Kislev, 19th day of Kislev. Why is Yad Kislev. Why? Exactly. He was let out of jail in 1798 in St. Petersburg. He was brought to trial because people, these infighting between the Misnagdim and the Chassidim, and landed him in jail. In 1764, as a great already Talmudic scholar, he was married in 1760. In 1764, he was interested in learning about Chassidus, saying that he knew a little about learning, but not about prayer, about devotion. So he went to the Holy Maggid of Mezrich, and then he became one of the Mezricher Maggid's close Talmidim. The Mezricher Maggid was the disciple, the chief disciple of the Baal Shem. And there, the Rav Shneur Zalman became one of the close Talmidim, and he was actually the author in 1770 of what we call now, today we call it the Rav Shulchan Aruch, the Shulchan Aruch HaRav. He authored an updated edition of the Shulchan Aruch at the behest of the Maggid, who said, we have a lot of decisions that have been rendered since the publication of the Shulchan Aruch in the 16th century. So Rav Shneur Zalman, because he was a brilliant Talmudist and a great halachist, he wasn't just a kind of a pietistic monk. He was a great gaon in learning, like many other Hasidic masters. So he was responsible to craft, and many use it today, not just in Chabad. Many posts, if you look in the footnotes in the Mishneh Berurah, which is like a latter-day compendium by the Chafetz Chaim, edited by the Chafetz Chaim, of halachic works, you'll find often Gimel Reish Zion in the footnotes. Who is Gimel Reish Zion? Gaon Reb Zalman. So that's a reference to the Alter Rebbe's Shulchan Aruch, which is used not just, like I'm saying, it's not just used in Chabad. In 1797, he published Likutei Amorim, which was anonymous. That's the page you have in front of you, which we call Tanya. That's what you have in front of you. He publishes the Tanya. Then he has some problems with one of the local Misnagdim. He has to leave St. Petersburg and settled in Liadi, and that's why he's known as Rav Shneur Zalman of Liadi. So in this Tanya, he talks about some of the basic philosophy of Chassidus, Chabad, Chassidus, for sure, this is the building blocks, and he has a beautiful Ha'ara here, an insight which I thought was really very fascinating, which speaks to the emphasis on simcha, on joy, that you'll find in the world of Chassidus in general. Says the Alter Rebbe, he says, you have to be careful. Vihine, bein shenafla lo ha'atzvos b'shas avoda b'talmud Torah o b'tfila, ubein shenafla lo shelo b'shas avoda zos, yosim el libo ke'en hazman grama ke'es la'atzvos amitis, afilo l'daigas avonos chamurim chas v'shalom. Says the Alter Rebbe, you know what you have to be careful of? You have to be careful of feeling down about yourself. He says, what could happen? A person could be in the middle of Avodas Hashem. They're in the middle of davening. And then they say to themselves, look at me. Am I really worthy of speaking to God? Who am I? I'm just a nothing. I have so many Averis. And they'll feel a sense of atzvos, of sadness. So, says the Alter Rebbe, sadness is a good thing. It's okay to have sadness. Constructive sadness, feeling the sadness of being far from God. But, says the Alter Rebbe, sadness needs to be at a specific time, in a specific place. Even, he says, even when you're davening, if a person feels that they're sad because they're far away, that's not the time. A person's driving the car and they realize, wow, mamish, I need to do tshuva. And they start feeling bad about themselves, the Rebbe says, that's not a good thing. Be karon, we need to be in a state of simcha, in the state of the presence of God, in the sense of joy. Of course, there's a place for sadness. For those who saw, there was a very powerful movie last year. I would not recommend taking children to this movie because it's very intense, although it is a children's movie. It's called Inside Out. It's mamish, very intense. And part of the story about that is about the story of sadness and the place of sadness. It's not about joy, but says the Alter Rebbe, there is a place for sadness. The Alter Rebbe never saw Inside Out, but he meant there is a place for sadness, but specifically that expression is used. There's a place for it. There's a time for it. It has to be at a specific time. A person, it's not total joy. It's not dancing in the streets all the time and never introspecting. It's not being lack of seriousness, but it has to be in a specific time, because otherwise that could actually detract from a person's avodas Hashem. And I would say that especially in our time, that's something that we need to emphasize. If a person always goes around saying, I'm nothing, I have not accomplished anything, I'm a failure, so then taka, they won't strive for anything great. But if they build themselves up, and then they have specific times that are used for introspection, then you have, I think, today, a greater recipe. So the emphasis in Chassidus on Simcha doesn't preclude the appropriateness of sadness and introspection in the right time. Okay, the last on the yellow sheets is Rebbe Akiva Eiger. Rebbe Akiva Eiger, born in Eisenstadt in 1780, went to Lisa, and in 1814 he becomes the Rav of Posen. So Posen is a town. If you look on the inside of your front cover map, if you look on number 5, you see Posen is in the Prussian area. So it's a highly German and acculturated community with actually a lot of maskilim. He established a major yeshiva there. One thing that I learned in preparing, I found there's a great volume by a teacher of mine, Rabbi Daniel Mann, about some of the great achronim, and he has a small biography of Rebbe Akiva Eiger. I never realized this. Rebbe Akiva Eiger was not just a rabbinic luminary and a genius. Unbelievable. He was also a very active community person, especially in the realm of Bikur Cholim. He took it upon himself to personally visit the sick on a regular basis, and even when he became too busy, he had emissaries, and he established a hospital in Posen. He was responsible for establishment of a hospital, and then there was a cholera epidemic in 1831 in which he established certain takanos to care for the sick people of the cholera epidemic, and he received a royal message of thanks from Frederick William III for his services. I don't know how it was possible for the man to become such a great Talmudic giant and at the same time be worrying about Bikur Cholim, but like this is just another instance where you see the greatness of a person in Torah, but also in their Bein Adam L'Chaveiro. Unbelievable. I never realized. The man established a hospital on his own and sustained it. And then after he died, I think some of his Yerusha went to maintaining that hospital. I think he writes that in the same thing. He was also the father-in-law of the Chassam Sofer, Rav Moshe Sofer, the Pressburger Rosh Hashiva. We spoke about him last year. We're not going to have time to talk about him this year. So Rabbi Akiva Eiger wrote very important tshuvas. In addition to his commentary on the Shas, his glosses on the Shulchan Aruch, he also wrote very important tshuvas. So this tshuva, Shalos Tshuvas Rabbi Akiva Eiger, that we have here, this is in the Psakim in Orachaim. I think it's in Siman Zayin. I forgot to write the number on the top. He quotes something from the Notabi Yehuda. The Notabi Yehuda also wrote glosses on the Shulchan Aruch called Dogel Meravava, where the Notabi Yehuda says you have to have a problem, you have to have a concern. The following might happen. Let's say a husband and a wife, they're married. The husband davens in shul Friday night. He comes home to make kiddush for his wife. Says the Notabi Yehuda, we have a problem because women are obligated in kiddush on a biblical level. But the husband, because he davened Maariv in shul, already discharged his biblical obligation with the recitation of Maariv. So now he's only obligated rabbinically to recite Kiddush on a cup of wine. So how can the husband, who's only obligated rabbinically, discharge the obligation, be motzi the wife, who's still obligated biblically? That's the problem that the Notabi Yehuda poses. So the conclusion of Rabbi Akiva Eiger is that's not a problem, because just like the man is included in what we call arvus, the women are also included in arvus, in co-responsibility. So therefore, just like a man who made Kiddush already can be motzi other men who didn't hear Kiddush, even if he already recited Kiddush, you can make Kiddush 100 times. I mean, you have to be careful what you make Kiddush on, but this, you can make Kiddush 100 times. You can blow the shofar 100 times. So too women, says the Gaon Rebbe Akiva Eiger, are also included in arvus, and therefore, even though they're not on the same level of obligation, because they share the co-responsibility of mitzvos called arvus, even though the man already was yotzi min haTorah, he could be motzi the wife. This, if you add, tack this on to a comment of Rabbi Akiva Eiger on the Shulchan Aruch, in Hilchos Kiddush, actually has a different level. Rabbi Akiva Eiger, basing himself on earlier sources, the Rambam has an important lashon about this, not for today. Rabbi Akiva Eiger makes a comment that, well, it's not just that when you say the Shemona Esrei, are you fulfilling Kiddush? Because Kiddush is a herald. It's a declaration. We're welcoming the Sabbath. So says Rabbi Akiva Eiger, with any declaration, if you say Good Shabbos to someone, so you have now fulfilled your celebratory declaration of Kiddush. Even though the Rambam says it has to be Zechirah Shevach, Let's keep the Rambam out of it for a moment. So if you say good Shabbos, so many poskim point out, let's say you're in Yerushalayim, you're a Kodesh, and you're going to take a taxi on Saturday night, on Motzoi Shabbos. So sometimes the taxi drivers are observant, and sometimes they're not observant. But generally speaking, when you greet a taxi driver on Motzoi Shabbos, what do you say to them? Shavua Tov. So now, says Rabbi Kiveger, by saying Shavua Tov, you have fulfilled your mitzvah of Havdalah. Minatura. You fulfilled your mitzvah of Havdalah. So it's a good idea when you get on the bus, Motzoi Shabbos, or you get in the taxi on Saturday night, or when you go to the pizza shop, you say to the person who's there, not observant, you say to them, Shavua Tov, and when they answer you, Shavua Tov, they therefore are Mekayim, their mitzvah of Havdalah, Minat Torah. In addition to the Arvis, I'm not saying, when you get, you might want to like have a portable Havdalah set. Like you get in the cab and you whip out the candle and you're like, all right, here we go. When I was in yeshiva. Yes, it's based on Shabbat Shalom. Rabbi Kiva Eger's comment is on the Shabbat Shalom. So you see somebody Friday night, they're not observing. You say to them Shabbat Shalom, they say Shabbat Shalom back. They're Makai in the midst of Kiddush Minat Torah.
So when the wife says Shabbat Shalom to her husband, now she's out of
Kiddush. Exactly. So that might be the other answer, that if the wife says Shabbat Shalom, so she will have fulfilled her mitzvah Minat Torah. And then even according to the Dagal Meravava, the husband will be motzi the wife because they're both only Mechuyev Midrabanan. Exactly. That would be the other answer using that other Kiddush of Rabbi Kiva Eger. What's that? That's right. But you still need Midrabanan, you still need the cup. All right. In the remaining 15 minutes, we're going to just do the last green packet quickly. Because some of these are familiar and some of these are not so. But the Vilna Gaon, so he established this chain of the yeshiva world, so to speak. His chief pupil, Reb Chaim Lavolozhiner, established the Volozhiner Yeshiva. He is succeeded by his son, Reb Yitzchak Lavolozhiner. And then the Netziv is the son-in-law after the Reb Lezer Yitzchak Fried dies after a very short time. He dies in 1854. Reb Yitzchak Lavolozhiner dies in 1849. After 1854, when his successor dies, so he is succeeded by the Netziv, Rav Ravkali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, who is the son-in-law of Rav Itzel of Volozhiner, who is the son of Rav Chaim Volozhiner. And this yeshiva becomes, so to speak, like the mother of almost all major European yeshivas and the yeshivas that we know today, with one major exception, that is Yeshivas Mir. Yeshivas Mir doesn't really fit. It's not connected with the Volozhin-Lithuanian yeshiva, but the vast majority of the other yeshivas. So we'll take a look for a brief moment at the Netziv. If you look on your map, Volozhin is in modern day, I think it's Belarus. Who wrote a beautiful one-line tribute to the Netziv? None other than Chaim Nachman Bialik. Bialik wrote a famous poem about his experience in Volozhin. It's not the most beautiful description of a very cloistered yeshiva bacha's life in Volozhin, but he has a very beautiful tribute, one line, to the great loving sage, the Netziv, Rav Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, who was a great rabbinic figure in an area of scholarship that was not so popular. So, for example, the Netziv wrote a comment on the Medrash Halacha. We have a commentary of the Netziv. We also have the commentary of the Netziv on the She'iltos of Rav Achoy Gon, which is a very obscure work. We don't have time to talk about it today. In addition to his commentary on Chumash called Hamek Davar, etc. So the Netziv also published Responsum, which we're not going to focus on today, Hamek Meshiv Davar, which were published in 1879, and then later after his death. He dies in 1893. We're not going to talk about the controversy about the closing of the Volozhin Yeshiva. For those who were here, we actually spoke about it, I don't know, at some point last year. We spoke about the Netziv and the closing of Volozhin Yeshiva. For more information, see Rabbi Jacob J. Schachter's article on the Netziv and Secular Studies and the Closing of Volozhin Yeshiva. The one piece that I brought for you is the Netziv's introduction to Sefer Bereishis. The Netziv says, you know why Sefer Bereishis is called Sefer HaYashar? It's because the Avos were Yesharim. What does it mean to be Yashar? How would you translate that in English?
Straight,
honest. The best translation is in Yiddish, which is Erlich. Be Erlich. Says the Netziv, you know why the Avos were called Yesharim? Because they treated everybody properly. Avraham Avinu, he prayed for the people of Sodom, the most wicked people. And yet, the Avos, they are called Yesharim, because he saw they're also people. So to be Erlich, to be just, to be upright, means to treat all people with Yashrus. That's the Netziv. Again, I'm just a regalachas. One of the Netziv's chief disciples, his chief pupils, was the Gaon Rav Avram Yitzchak HaKohen Cook, born in 1865 in Griva in Latvia. He studies in Volozhin. He actually is the only student at that time, in his time. At the time when Rav Cook is in Volozhin, at the height of Volozhin Yeshiva, they have 400 students. Most of them, they're living in the homes of nearby Balabatim. They have meals by the Balabatim, something called Kest. They're learning in the Yeshiva. In 1888, Rav Cook is appointed the rabbi of a small town called Zalmel, and then later in Boisk. And then in 1904, he comes to Eretz Yisrael, where he becomes the chief rabbi of Yafo. So obviously, to talk about Rav Cook on one leg is impossible. And certainly, I'm not expert in anything. Certainly not expert in Rav Cook. But one observation I wanted to share with you about Rav Cook is from this hesped that you have on the next page, which is just two out of about an eight-page hesped that Rav Cook delivered for none other than Theodor Herzl. Right? Theodor Herzl, Shane aboard, nicht prim, let's just say. Right? He's a great-looking beard, very active Zionist, not religious at all. So people were outraged. How could it be that Rav Kook is going to give a hesped for Herzl? And I think this hesped speaks to so much about the philosophy of Rav Kook. Rav Kook also spoke at the founding of the Hebrew University. That's another story which we have. Dr. Lyman Schneer has an article on that. Rav Kook also has a letter at the founding of the Bezalel Art School. A lot of these fit into the same motif as what he describes here. He refers to Herzl indirectly, but not so obliquely, as the Mashiach. How could he be the Mashiach? So Rav Kook says, wait a second, look carefully in the Gemara Maseches Sukkah, where the Gemara tells us there are actually two Mashiachs. There's Mashiach ben Yosef and Mashiach ben David. What was Yosef's job in Egypt? Hu ha-mashbir l'cholam ha-aretz. He was responsible for the physical and social and economic sustenance of the community. Says Rav Kook, there are two aspects to the Mashiach. There's Mashiach ben Yosef, who is responsible for building the physical, the whole. And then there's Mashiach ben David. You're right. Herzl and the secular Zionist movement, they're not the ideal. That's not the goal. The goal is a spiritual world guided by the Torah, by the light of godliness that is bringing the world to its tikkun, whether we like it or not. It's happening. There is godliness that's driving the world. It's directing the world. That's the goal. But to get there, you can have chol. You can have secular, basic sustenance, basic institutions. He didn't live to see the state, but the state, the settlements, all of these things, you can build the Kodesh on top of the Chol. And not just that. It's not just building Kodesh on top of Chol. The Chiddush is that there's Kedusha in the Chol. Because what they're doing is also part of the process. And the Chiddush that Rav Kook writes is that Dafka, when you have these two Kochos in synergy with each other, then you have a completeness. You can't have one without the other. So it's not just that we tolerate the secular Zionists, it's that we celebrate the secular Zionists, not because they reflect the complete ultimate vision of what we're looking for, but because they do reflect an important component of what Hashem expects of us living in a physical world. And this is an idea that is manifest in the way that Rav Kook related to secular Zionists. It wasn't that Rav Kook was blind to the shortcomings. Rav Kook, I have a whole book at home of Kol Koris, of placards that Rav Kook put up. And one of them is a placard against the desecration of Shabbos by going to soccer games on Shabbos. Rav Kook was very aware of what's religious and what's not religious. And he didn't compromise in any way, shape, or form. And at the same time, he was able to see from his glasses the values of those contributions of the secular Zionists and his relationship with many of the Gedolei Torah of that time. Even, let's say, the Rav of the Yeshiva Hayashan, Rav Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld, was very positive. However, his rayonot, his ideas, many of them very revolutionary, were not appreciated by some of the other politicals of the time, and it became somewhat of a controversial figure. But he is the kind of the foundation stone of what we call modern religious Zionist philosophy to a great extent. Now, there's a great debate about Rav Kook's legacy and his student, his son Rav Tzvi Yehuda, and other Talmidim Rav Kook. Anyway, in kamalkam laharach, that's not for today. We don't have enough time. We needed to talk about a Holocaust figure, of course. And so we chose the Gaon, the Tzaddik, the righteous Hashem Yikom Domo, of Kolonimus Kalman Shapira, the Rebbe of the Warsaw Ghetto. Some of the people in this room have heard me talk about him a lot. And we'll continue to talk about him. But what I wanted to talk about today from Kolonimus Kalman was not actually his work in the Holocaust and not the Drush of Eish Kodesh, which would be another time. There is a prominent scholar today. He was in Chicago for a while. His name is Rabbi Dr. Mark Gottlieb. So he has a book review, an essay published in the Jewish Review of Books of a recent second translation of the Chovos HaTalmidim, the work of the Pia Setzner, written for high school students. So there was an original translation, I think it was published by Aronson, and then another translation that was published by Feldheim. This work is really incredible. It's published in 1932. It's a work that is focused on high school students, which was the focus of his life as yeshiva called Das Moshe. And in this work, you see on the next page, he describes, we're not going to read it inside, what Rabbi Gottlieb points out is an educational philosophy that is 70 years ahead of its time. It's called child-centered education. He says we're having a problem. He says, what's our problem? He says, we have kids who are going off the derech. Off the derech in Poland in 1932. So first of all, the thought of a Hasidic master even acknowledging the fact that there are kids who are going off the derech is amazing. But what's his solution? He says, it's not their fault, it's ours. It's our responsibility. Don't blame the kids who are going off the derech. What's the answer? He says, our educational philosophy needs to adapt to the reality that today, young people think they know everything before they really do. He was mamash a prophet. He's talking about kids who are in fifth grade, who have Google, who think they have all the answers. So he says, you know what the answer is? You know how we have to educate kids today? He says, we have to cultivate within them a sense that they are the educators. They are responsible to educate themselves, and we are their facilitators. We're their helpers. We're there to help them cultivate the spark of godliness that is within them, to show them what that responsibility is, what that opportunity is. It's child-centered education. We could spend, and I'm not going to keep apologizing for this, I'll just keep noting, because it's important to note, we could spend an entire hour, this was the topic of something we did a couple of weeks ago in West Rogers Park, we spent an entire hour just parsing this piece of the Chovos HaTalmidim, maybe it's worth coming back to. It is amazing. It's incredible, especially if you think about who wrote it and when he wrote it. We'll close with the Chazon Ish and Rav Soloveitchik. The Chazon Ish, born in 1878, comes on Aliyah in the early 1930s, 1933, from Vilna. He was essentially known as the right-hand man of Rav Chaim Ozer Grudzinski, who was the greatest rabbinic luminary in Vilna at that time, in the world at that time. He got shalos from all over the world. He moved to Vilna in 1920, and Rav Chaim Ozer would consult with him on a regular basis about the most difficult shalos. The Chazon Ish was largely self-taught, and he was an incredible scholar. The volumes of the Chazon Ish, he has over 22 volumes. I think he has 23 chiburim in halacha, in every aspect, from the most pedestrian to the most complex kachim and taros. Nothing eluded him. He became the greatest rabbinic giant of the community of Bnei Brak when he arrives in Israel, and in a certain sense, he becomes one of the authoritative figures in the Torah community in general. On October 14th, 1965, a man came to visit him in Bnei Brak. His name was David Ben-Gurion, and Ben-Gurion came to talk to him about different issues of state, and one of them was Giyus Bachurei Yeshiva, about yeshiva boys going to the army. And we know exactly what happened because Yitzchak Navon, who was later to become the fifth president of Israel, was Ben-Gurion's secretary, and he was there. Yitzchak Navon just died a few months ago, I think in November or September, something like that. So Yitzchak Navon described in an interview that interaction about how religious and non-religious Jews can live together in the state of Israel. So the Chazon Ish said to him, look, the Gemara has a discussion about when you have two camels at a crossroads. One of them has a pack, a heavy burden, and one of them doesn't. The burdened one goes first. So he says, we're carrying the burden of the tradition of Torah for thousands of years. We should go first. We have to go first. So then, so Ben-Gurion said to him, so we also have a burden. We're trying to settle this land. So they went back and forth. The Chazon Ish said, well, I know that your soldiers are protecting the land, but you know the only reason that your soldiers are sustained is because of the Torah learning that's happening in the religious community. So these are two major figures representing two important ideological positions. Now, the Chazon Ish is known traditionally as a very significant machmir, and yet, at the same time, not always realized the Chazon Ish was also at times significantly makel, sometimes very lenient. So the piece that I chose for you today is only one of two pieces in the Chazon Ish where it makes the same point about non-religious Jews today. The Gemara and the Rambam discuss a concept called Morid Ve'in Malin, about how we treat people who are mumorim, who are heretics. But the Chazon Ish quotes in this piece, he says, today, it's impossible to call these people heretics, these non-observant people. Who was mochiach them? Who gave them tochacha to get them on the straight and narrow? Nobody today has the capacity to be kochacha, to give tochacha. They're what we call tinok shenishba. And therefore, you have to relate to them with avosos ava, relating to them with love. And the last comment is going to come from Rav Soloveitchik, from the hesped of the Tolner Rebbetzin that we have mentioned many times. What's the most important thing in life? When we summarize all the learning that we've done the last 3 weeks, the Masorah that took us all the way back from Rabbeinu Gershom or Hagola till today, that is to understand the basic fundamental point. Everything boils down to what my mother taught me. What did I learn from my mother, says Rav Soloveitchik? To feel the presence of the Almighty and the gentle pressure of His hand resting upon my frail shoulders. That's the most important thing in life. Not just in Torah, not just in raising children, and keep in mind always to feel the presence of the Almighty and the gentle pressure of His hand resting upon my frail shoulders. That's why we are embracing the Torah, because through the experience of Torah, we really feel that closeness to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. We really feel the gentle pressure of His hand. And by connecting to the Chachmei HaMasorah, to realizing just how giant they were, and for me, as someone who could just collect just the sparks or the crumbs, it's still great. Because it enables us to feel that connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu in our lives.